You're listening to ABC Radio National's MP3 and podcast of The Law Report. Find out more, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to The Law Report. Today, another opportunity to listen to a program that I did a little while ago that explores a very interesting intersection between law and art. Glenda Brigham is a court illustrator for Channel 10 in Melbourne. Because we don't allow cameras in our courtrooms, it's the job of the court artist to draw images of the accused, which are then often put on our TV screens or published in our newspapers. Now, if you're imagining small black pen sketches, think again. Glenda works on A3 size paper in watercolour and pastels. I visited Glenda Brigham's studio at her home. At the end of the house was a light-filled studio, the walls lined with her work. And in the middle of the room, an enormous workbench covered with piles of illustrations. It's a room full of haunting images of people in docks, people facing serious accusations, people facing the consequences of their actions. It's a time when strange aspects of human nature sometimes emerge. One drawing which caught my eye was an illustration of a man sitting in a dock in what looked like a courtroom in Melbourne's historic Supreme Court building. Glenda explained that in court that day, a man was pleading guilty to manslaughter.
When I walked in, it was about to begin, and I sat, got permission from the tip staff, which was really great, to sit up near the dock, and had this wonderful view looking through the bars. But unfortunately, as you'll notice, the top rail intersected right through his face. So I just commenced drawing him when he looked down and noticed me, because it was before the proceedings had started. So he smiled at me, and then this incredible gleeful look came over his face of joy that I was drawing him and he was some sort of celebrity.
He enjoyed the attention.
Well, this was the amazing part. I expect most people are very reluctant to pose for you and don't want you to draw them at all. But in this case, this particular man, who was rather handsome looking in a classic sense, was absolutely rapt that I was drawing him. And I almost, normally you don't have any communication with the accused, but in this particular case, I gestured to him and sort of indicated that I wanted him to stare straight ahead because he kept looking at me all the time and moving his head and smiling, which is exactly the wrong thing for when you're trying to draw someone that's at a plea. To be smiling directly at me sort of seemed quite bizarre. And when the proceedings eventually started, I started to... It filtered through what a tragic circumstance it had brought him to be in this position. And I thought, well, this is really quite bizarre that here's this man at his plea and yet he's smiling at me. And so I thought, well, he's obviously not taking the situation very seriously. In order to get around this aspect of being able to draw his face completely, I lifted the rail above. And when I got back to the studio to render it and prepare it for the news, I looked at it again and I thought, intuitively, I've drawn this man almost as if he's in a little cage or a playpen. It's diminished him, the way it actually appears, like he looks like the child. It had actually come through that his immaturity is being, even though I hadn't consciously done it, his immaturity is really showing through in the drawing.
Glenda, what's the rationale behind court illustrators or court artists? Why do we have these quite detailed, quite beautiful illustrations on our TV screens and in our newspapers, but we can't have photos or cameras?
Well, that is the most common question that I get asked. Why don't they just go in and get really good pictures of these people with cameras? It's ridiculous, people like you drawing them. And I, of course, have to justify my occupation, but it's more than that. It's forced me to really think about the whole issue of it. And the most obvious one that comes to my mind is the incredible security we've got these days when we go into court. And you think of what can be concealed in tiny objects. Like, for example, look what happened in Madrid with mobile phones. So to even go in with a camera, anything could be concealed within that camera. That's one of the points I'd like to make. The other thing is that often when you go in to draw people, you're in, it's probably one of the last spaces in our society that is hallowed, in, if you'll excuse me using the word. But you think about how churches used to be until we've had the advent of video filming people at weddings and so forth. And I think that this is a serious place, and there has to be certain protocol. When you walk into court, you have to bow, you have to go through certain rituals to mark your respect. Now, you're not allowed to wear sunglasses. You have to remove anything it might have on your head. Now, I think that to have a person come in with a camera and just walk around, or even a video camera filming people present, would definitely take away from the seriousness of the occasion. Like I mentioned that man earlier, the one that acted childishly, that's what was so jolting, was his lack of respect. And I think you've got to not only have respect, there's another element to it as well. Often you might have, like recently I had to go in and draw an accused. The security was incredible getting into the court. And several times I was approached by court staff saying, make sure you don't draw anyone else but the person that's accused, for the simple reason that they had witnesses under protective custody there. Now, if you allow people in with cameras, they could take photographs of anyone. They could also take photographs of grieving and distraught relatives who may feel violated while they're there. So I think that when you go into court and you know that you have to behave in a certain way, and court artists are there as officially part of the court, people feel, most of the time people just look at me as part of the scene, that they've seen people on television, they're familiar with the fact that there are court artists, so although they don't want to, even the accused, they don't want to be drawn, they will acknowledge that you're there as an official person. So, like, this is an interesting case, this one.
Describe the image for me.
We've got a portly man standing with his arms tentatively in front of him, just his hands folded in front of him, actually, not his arms crossed, looking quite vulnerable and apprehensive. He's got it's a profile view of him. He's quite portly.
And not terribly menacing.
No, there's a vulnerability there, I think, which is what I captured. He was rather a tragic case of a man that became addicted to the pokies and used to spend up to 16 hours a day. And he'd had a very respectable job, and he actually, in order to support his habit, he'd stolen millions of dollars.
So who did he steal from?
Well, he'd stole millions of dollars from his employer, and he was in a responsible position where he was advising people and had been, you know, obviously held in high regard up until this point.
So tell me, what went through your mind as you made this illustration?
First of all, it was in the New County Court, a very small court. There was a lot of intimacy involved in the drawing of this. I was very close to him. And I found a seat in the back of the court right next to the dock, so I could almost touch him. So there's that, sometimes that, although it can be great for drawing, it also can be quite confronting. What happened here was there was an empty seat sitting next to me, which was, I was there early, a lady came and sat next to me, and I was about to commence drawing him when she whispered in my ear, "Don't make him look evil, he's a good man, he's my brother." Now, you can imagine what I felt like, because I couldn't be personal. I had to just draw what I could see. I had to be detached, and yet for a moment it brought me out of that detachment, that here was this person that she was saying, pleading with me. She said, "He's a good man, and if this hadn't have happened, he'd always led a good life until now." So I was in this mental state of oscillating between feeling for her and for him, and yet trying to be detached, because you can't draw unless you're detached, and draw only what you see, not what you feel.
Well, do you find that if you know about what somebody has done or is alleged to have done, that that does impact on the way you draw? And I'm thinking perhaps when we're talking about grisly crimes.
Definitely, definitely. I think as I've become more experienced with this, I deliberately do not ask anything at all about the crime. I just prefer to get the name. I have to have the name because one time I actually went to the county court and drew someone and it was the magistrate's court. And I was wondering why there was no one else there. But the man that I was drawing was really flattered, I might add, that I was drawing him.
And do you try to switch off to what's being discussed in court?
If you are drawing, in order to draw, you have to be in the right hemisphere. You've got to be detached. You've got to be able to look at that person almost like they're a still life object. And then it starts to work. Once you get into that state of mind where you are detached and you are drawing, you do hear information, sometimes heinous information, but you're in such a state of detachment that although you can hear dreadful things, they're not impacting on you because you are focusing, you're in a zone, you are focusing in on the subject, and you're looking at how one shape connects with another shape, and that's all it is. And it's not until afterwards when you get out, it starts to hit you.
I'm Damien Carrick and you're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National. Today I'm visiting the studio of court artist Glenda Brigham. We've spoken about people who liked being drawn. Have there been subjects who've been pretty upset and angry with you when you've drawn them? Not just people who are sort of in the court, but the actual subject themselves.
Yes, quite a number of times there have been some people. I think that when it involves a crime of incredible shame in particular, they can be very, very angry. This one was a man who was accused of, he'd conducted a number of rapes. And this was at the sentence in the county court, and he's standing upright with his hands. The body language always fascinates me with a lot of these people. A lot of rapists stand with their hands folded in front of them, sort of
in front of their groin. You say
yes, and I think that's quite fascinating when you consider the link with the crime somehow.
What do you think that's about?
This is a common experience with pedophiles, rapists, is to have their arms folded across with their hands crossing in front of them. And in Alan Pease's book, he mentions that this is a vulnerability and that men are actually, not men necessarily, but when a person crosses and holds their hands, one hand with another, it actually is subliminally traced back to that child holding the parent's hand. So they're actually holding hands with themselves. And I think that's quite fascinating, that they are standing there in a very vulnerable position, usually at a sentence, and they feel under threat. They're alone and frightened. I interpret it as fear.
Well, tell me, what happened when you were drawing this subject? What looks like a sort of a large middle-aged man with sort of a moustache and beard.
When I arrived there, I'd got there early and I was fairly close, and it's a very small, in the new county court, the courts are very intimate. So you're very, very close to the dock. He was standing and he saw me come in. I was sitting fairly close. There was hardly anyone else around except for one of the prison guards, and he just saw me with my sketch pad and he said, "I don't want you to draw me," and got, well, very aggressive towards me. And then when I heard the crimes, I realised that he really had a hatred of women. So here's this person that had perpetrated crimes in exerting his power over women, having this reverse situation where a woman is drawing him and he is feeling like powerless because he couldn't do anything about it except verbally accost me. But it did affect me. It did actually. The verbal abuse, if it's got a lot of energy behind it, can actually almost be like a physical. I did feel really affected by him doing that, and it took me a while to compose myself. And in fact, I couldn't even use the pencil. I was shaking so much. And I think hearing the crime and trying to draw him, having had the experience of him verbally accosting me, worked on me, and I had to try desperately to detach. But physically it affected me because I was shaking so much, I thought I can't draw him. So what I resorted to in the end was getting out what they call a stump, which is it looks like a stick with a point on the end, pointing on both ends. It's made of sort of felt or paper. And I actually drew him by getting the stump and rubbing a carbon pencil into the stump. And I knew that if I worked with a thicker, a freer approach, I'd get something down, and it might then I was settled enough to actually finish it off in the pencil.
We're now looking at two framed illustrations, which I can see from small plaques at the bottom of the frames have actually won awards. Describe this one to me on the left. There are two very forlorn figures sitting in a dock.
It's interesting your choice of word, forlorn. I had this hanging up in my studio for about 6 months, and everyone that walked into the studio said straight away, as soon as they saw it, oh, that's that poor, sad woman who left her child in the car and the child died. Isn't that sad? So there's something about the essence of this drawing that really comes through.
What do you mean she left her child in the car?
She was addicted to the pokies, and a very lonely person, couldn't speak English, and isolated in suburbia, and went off one hot morning and went in and just forgot about the child, left the child in the car. Temperatures were up in the 40s. The child went into a coma. By the time they got the child out, the child was too far, had dehydrated and died. It was a really tragic, tragic case.
Describe the image to me.
You've got a composition where you've got the dock coming up, covering just about all their bodies, right up to even the chin of these two heads. The figure on the left is the accused, and she is in profile. There's really minimal information. I was sitting fair way back, and the lighting is never good in the Supreme Court. I couldn't even see what colour or items of her clothing. So I thought at first when I drew, I thought, well, this looks ridiculous. A little tiny bit of a profile in the middle of a page. So I then noticed that she had an interpreter next to her, and the interpreter was front on. The woman was, in fact, turning her head towards the interpreter to have everything explained to her. So I thought, well, I can work with the other head and use that to balance her and also bring about some sort of narrative to explain why she's like that, why her head's turning to the side instead of straight ahead.
So this, in many ways, a very simple illustration. Actually, this won a Court Illustration Award. Why do you think it won?
It's the minimal aspect of it. I think that because I saw so little of her, I could have gone and developed the surroundings a lot more. I could have done the architraves and all that sort of thing and brought it right up and made it quite a spectacular sort of drawing, but it would have lost its emotional content. She's the only thing in sharp focus, this minimal bit of information of this profile, this woman, and there is an expression in the eye I was able to get, you know, even though it's quite small. I thought it was very strange out of all my drawings that I actually hung this one up, even though I didn't have it at the time a great deal of satisfaction when I did it because I was thinking, gee, I didn't get much of her. I for some reason hung it in the studio, and everyone that walked in would say, wow, that's really sad. The same, and you said use the word forlorn, so that verifies it. It really conveys that emotional content. And I think the other thing was, it was the positive outcome that came out of this case were all those new laws dealing with pokey machines, having to put daylight into the buildings, having to put little clocks on the poker machines and all that sort of thing. So it's a very significant case, really.
I'm Damien Carrick and you're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National. Today speaking with court artist Glenda Brigham. Another image on her studio workbench was of a very young man with his eyes downcast, sitting in a dock next to a court officer. While drink driving, this teenager killed two of his friends and seriously injured two others. He pleaded guilty to two counts of culpable driving. Glenda was in court the day of his sentence. Also in court that day, a parent of each of the dead young men spoke to the court about their loss.
The image triggers a memory of the circumstances under which it was created, and it would have to be one of the most emotionally charged settings that I've ever been in. It involved a young boy who'd virtually destroyed his life by drinking and driving, and this was at the sentence, and the subject is sitting with his eyes down. He did not move or show any facial expression whatsoever. So I suppose by this point of the case, he'd spent the whole duration of the trial and the committal and everything to learn to sit there absolutely impassive, with not even looking up. What really got to me was while I was drawing him, the mother went up, the judge permitted the mother and the father to get up and read or speak from the witness box to release some pain somehow by giving victim impact statements. And I've never heard anything quite like the victim impact statement of the mother's. The way the mother expressed herself, somehow it was almost poetic, her description of her relationship with her child, the fact that she was ridden with fear of her even allowing her children to go out anywhere, that something might happen to them. And she said this, and I can almost, it almost seems like I'm remembering her words. And both families were present and everyone was crying. Even by the time I finished this drawing, even the journalists, who you never see show emotion like this, were crying as well, along with me. She said, my son was only 16. He came and he said, goodbye, Mum. And I saw him at the door smiling at me, and he will forever remain 16 in my mind for the rest of my life. That's how I'll see him. And I'll never see him become what he might have been. He's just been frozen in time, this face in my mind. I lie in my bed. I see this face. This is all I ever see. And while I just, as a mother, you know, like I just could not keep detached. Because everyone was crying and that energy was there, and her words were cutting through every level to me, and I could not remain detached. The tears were just pouring down my face and just splashing on the page, and I thought, my goodness, this is going to turn into, I won't need to render it, it's already a watercolour. And in fact, it got to the point where they have social workers in the court there to offer support. And, you know, I'd never really noticed their presence ever before, but they must have said, this is going to be a really sad one. And it was also in a big court. There were a lot of people there, lots of young people, lots of family members. Everyone had lost something out of this. She leaned forward and she gave me some tissues, and I thought, well, I never thought I'd be the one that would be emotionally supported. I was being emotionally supported while I was drawing it. But when we got back, all the journalists, everyone came out of that courtroom and they said that was the most tragic, the mother's statement was the thing that really got to everybody, absolutely everyone.
So, Glenda, you were obviously deeply affected by this tragic scene in the courtroom. How did it affect your drawing?
You've brought up a really interesting point here, because remember I said earlier the drawing I did of the Asian woman that had won an award. In those circumstances, I was totally detached, and all I was obsessed with doing is trying to actually get a picture of her. And it brought about a sense of creative part of me that looked for elements to make the drawing work. So I was thinking purely in an art form. I think what I don't feel real satisfaction in this drawing. Getting back to that, the case of the Asian woman, because after I finished that drawing, later when I drew her at the sentence, I by this stage had read an enormous amount about that woman and felt enormous empathy for her. And I remember consciously walking into the Supreme Court and thinking, I'm going to show this what this poor woman's been through. I'm going to put real emotion into this and make it a sympathetic portrayal of her. It'll be one of those moving pieces, you know. The more I struggled to put emotion into the drawing, the more demonic she became. In fact, I threw the drawing away. I was so embarrassed because I think that it was too emotionally charged, and I think that I had lost that level of detachment that's required. In this particular case, I've never felt... I think that I went through the same emotional processing. I became emotional, and I think I tried to then say, I remember thinking to myself, I must try and capture the emotional tension of what's going on around me and in me and convey this through this drawing. And I think that I tried to represent the emotion and lost the real way of getting it, which is just detaching and letting it filter through.
Terrific. Well, Glenda Brigham, thank you so much for showing me around your studio. It's been fascinating.
Well, I've enjoyed talking about it, really. I mean, I love what I do. I find it really fascinating. I'm learning all the time. Every time I do something, I come back and I look at it and I think, oh, I could have done this better or that better. And every now and again, something just works perfectly. So it's an exciting... And the other thing that's interesting about this occupation is you're hearing both sides when you're in court. You come out with a different perspective on things. You realise that life isn't black and white, that there is... It's completely tonal. That a lot of these people, there's other sides to the story. So in a way, it's not as frightening as the world may seem, because you're less fearful knowing everything sometimes. They're all human beings who, you know, when you hear, sometimes you sort of can almost understand how... through their life circumstances, they've led to this point where these crimes have been committed. So I think it's made me less judgmental doing it, in a way, really, instead of seeing the world in black and white.
Court artist Glenda Brigham. The book she referred to earlier by Alan Pease is titled Body Language. And on the Law Report website this week, in addition to the usual transcript and audio of the show, we'll have one or two examples of Glenda's work, which she discussed today. And if you've got a friend who would have just loved today's program but you know have missed it, don't worry, they can always go to the internet, because on our website at abc.net.au/rn we have transcripts of each program and audio of the last 4 weeks' programs. And don't forget, audio and a transcript of today's programs will be up at the ABC website at abc.net.au/rn from a little bit later on today. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next week with more law.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs broadcast on more than 260 transmitters, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Live streaming on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcasts.